This week on The Stack, we look at the 50 years of iconic title Time Out. Founded in London, the magazine is currently present in 108 cities. We speak to its founder and the CEO of the Time Out Group. And also, we cover a delightful title on the wonders of Ecuador. Stay tuned. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show celebrating 50 years of Time Out, the magazine which was founded in London by Tony Elliott and is celebrating its half century this month, became the foundation of what a city magazine is. Monaco's Tom Edwards spoke to Tony and to Julio Bruno, CEO of the Time Out Group.
Julio, Tony, welcome to Midori House. It's absolutely wonderful to have you with us. And I suppose I should start by saying happy birthday, really. I guess that's why we're here. It's an anniversary. Tony, let's kind of start by going way, way back, though. The 21-year-old Tony who got this thing started cannot possibly, or could he have, imagine that he'd be sat here today with such an extraordinary history.
No, of course not. It was, you know, when I started, it was a response, I suppose, to all the really interesting things that were going on, particularly from the kind of alternative independent sector, counterculture it was referred to then, and the information was hard to find. And I wanted to know about it, so I basically ended up doing a magazine for myself. And I think that we got good response from sales eventually, you know, fairly quickly, so that by the time you got into, we were every 3 weeks from, you know, August 1968. So when you got into the middle of 1969, you knew that the audience was there and very, very kind of dedicated, etc. So, I mean, I had a sort of confidence that, I certainly had a confidence that it would go on and on and on and on. Had no idea what size or ultimately what place we would end up. Where we
the
are.
Fearlessness of youth, I guess, plays its role with these things. So what were you, 21?
21
years old?
Yeah.
Yeah, extraordinary. See, these entrepreneurial types are amazing, aren't they, Julio?
Fearless. He's still fearless. Hasn't changed.
Yeah. And Julio, just tell us and tell our audience your association with Time Out. How far back does that go? And tell us what it's been like coming into something that obviously was, you know, it's a pretty iconic kind of brand, I guess. Tell us a bit about your association personally.
Well, it is an iconic brand, and that's why I joined in at the end of 2015 as executive chairman. Then becoming the group CEO in 16 when we took, or I took the company public in the London Stock Exchange, AIM. I joined Time Out because I knew Time Out. I've been, all my business and my life, I've been traveling around the world nonstop for work. And I used to pick up Time Out in places from Tokyo to Rio de Janeiro, whatever, all over the world. When I lived in London first in the 90s, I would be using Time Out. Because I was still, even though with the internet was beginning kind of thing, being more commercial, but still you needed to have that, what I call now a helping hand of what to do in a city where you can do 400 million things. And we didn't have FOMO on those days, right? But I think I did, like a lot of other people. I mean, I don't want to miss out on the good things. And Time Out was that inspiration and that information.
We didn't have the acronym, but I think we had the emotion.
It's a horrible acronym.
I know, sorry, Tony.
It's good. It's like portmanteau words. You love them or hate them. Mainly we hate them. Tony, let me ask you about, I guess, a trend which has informed Time Out throughout its life, really, and certainly as it got bigger and bigger. And that's, I guess it's almost a paradoxical thing, which is that the bigger you get, the more international the reach, certainly the international the ambition, the more you need to sort of almost restate your very local credentials. Has that been a balancing act? Because I guess people find it maybe harder to believe that a global brand can know the secrets just around the corner. And as you've already described, that was very much the kind of the selling point. It was countercultural. It was hyperlocal. Has that been a balancing act?
No, I don't think so. Because if you see Time Out today, ultimately as a, you know, great big worldwide database, it's been built up by a series of local databases. So almost everything we've ever done has had people and contributors in a particular city. And we've kept to cities largely, you know. I mean, that's partly, some of that came a bit from me because I always thought it was more interesting to do a city in detail and really up to date and contemporary than to do some kind of, you know, travel guide to France or, I mean, France or Spain or whatever. So it's very, very much city-based. And it's modular, you know, so it's very, very flexible kind of structure.
And let's reflect a little bit on that. And you already actually alluded to this when the remarks you've made already about the evolution of digital platforms and how they've reshaped the space or recalibrated it, I suppose. It's an inevitable question, but what's your view on how Time Out has stewarded its way through that challenge? It's now a multi-platform brand entity. Print isn't even the biggest component anymore, as it was for such a long time. Presumably that's been challenging. Do you remain very confident about the robust business models that you have in place, or that you're instigating, or you have been instigating in the last few years, to see that, you know, another 50 years?
Well, in another 500 years. It's not easy in this world of media, and now we are in media and entertainment. It still is not a robust model, right? Mm. But we are on our way to be that. I like to say that we are more platform agnostic, saying a fancy word, because we create this content that we have been creating for 50 years since Tony started this. And we keep creating that content in the same way. Now, because the world has changed, we put that content in many places. We put it in print. We still believe in print. We put it in digital. We put it in the app. And we even put it in our events or in our own Time Out Market, which where we serve food, if you want. And that food is also content. So in that world, that hasn't, you know, we have evolved. But the principal idea of inspiration and information is still there now in many more cities. And so I see this as a necessity today, because in the world of overwhelming information and misinformation, you still need that true ambassador of the city, that helping hand that says, you know, you could do a lot of things here, but we believe from a professional standpoint that these are the best things to do, the coolest things, the most interesting things to do in those cities that we cover.
And I just wonder on that point, is the deck, I mean, for a long time, the deck's been, I feel, almost stacked against brands or companies or concerns that are trying to do what Time Out does by the big search engines. We know they wield the power and they can leverage their control almost of search, if you like, to kind of push people around a little bit. How do you react to that? How do you have to, because it's inevitable, you must work with these big companies, but at the same time, you need to defend your revenue streams, which they're less sherry about. How do you strike that balance? And is that, presumably, again, that's one of the top challenges that you and Time Out faces?
Well, of course, it's a challenge because they are competitors and collaborators at the same time, right? Or co-competitors. It's not easy because they have the kind of resources that we cannot even dream of. Mm. It's impossible. I mean, that's done. The ship has sailed a long time ago with the likes of Google and others. What I like to say, and Tony and I discuss this quite often, is that we have to be true to ourselves, true to who we are. And we represent the city from the point of view of professionals that do this every day, rather than any super blogger, any influencer, any 14-year-old writing about this is my favorite dish. And all respect to that, because in the world today, everybody is having opinions, alternative facts, truth is not truth anymore. We are true to who we are. And that content, that we like to say that content is still king, is very important. And then, of course, our tone of voice, how we present the information, how we talk about it. And then when you talk in print, how do we design, how we present the brand? And there is a power of Time Out that is ubiquitous, that is also consistency in what you present, and people resonate with that. I mean, we have 217 million monthly global reach. That's not compared to 2 billion of Facebook, and we cannot and don't want to compete on that. But it's still sizable and growing.
I mean, also, I think if you use what I'm just going to say, any search engine, i.e. Google, and put in, you know, what are the best restaurants in, you know, Amsterdam or whatever, it doesn't matter what city, their system's not really capable of telling you what is genuinely the best. Whereas one of the things I think we have achieved now is that we are a recognised source of information that people who want to know the best would come to us, you know. So I think the search engine generally work good for us in the way that people can get information, but then they realize that the information is only of a certain kind of depth, and then people gradually can create a relationship with us, and they're complementary in a way. You know?
And that's interesting, because that's, I suppose, about authority, authenticity, which are kind of often used rather glibly, but that really matters if you're talking about a trusted voice. Mm. Just to pick up, though, Tony, with you on something that sort of Julio alluded to there, which is this idea of the supposedly democratizing power of digital. You know, isn't it great? Everyone's a journalist now. There's no barriers to entry. I wonder if that is such a good thing. I learned my trade, if I've learned anything, on newspapers, you know, the editor's fearsome red pen, and you learned how to do things properly. I know, well, you know, Monocle's editor here, your paths have crossed back in the Time Out days, of course, a man who knows how to wield the red pen. Yeah. Do you still worry about that fact, that there's not the same kind of rigour about training people how to tell a good story, how to be an authentic voice? You know, sometimes the old ways of doing things were a bit better, maybe.
I think in Time Out's case, one of the things that's amazed me in the last 10, 15 years is how all the people who work on the brand, basically, in any form, but particularly editorial, I always used to worry about new people kind of being getting what the DNA was and all the rest of it. And now it all happens almost automatically, which is fantastic. So I think that we retain our quality by virtue of what we do, but also because we're prepared to really make sure that we've got people on the ground in any place to write about things. And it goes more than that. You know, they all have expertise. You know, so in the old days when we used to printed guides, we used to run them like magazines with somebody who is in charge of the nightlife section and somebody in terms of art and somebody in terms of eating and drinking and so on. All those principles have still evolved, as Julia would say. It is hard to keep everything going at the same thing because the where the money comes from, all the rest of it changes. But the strength of what we do does cut through.
Well, let's talk a bit about the shifting sands of where the revenue comes from, where it is, where the new strands are to pursue. How do you look to, let's say, sort of like medium term, you know, sort of 3 to 5 year outlook? You've already mentioned the markets, all these other things. And it's interesting looking at the raw revenue data, you know, what comes from digital, what comes from market and all the rest of it. How fast changing is that landscape?
Well, it's changing fast. Diversification for Time Out is part of my DNA when I came to do and to achieve in the company. So when you look at the market, you know, we have a very profitable business in Lisbon. Last year, we had 3.6 million visitors. That means around 10,000 people a day. They're spending quite a lot of money in our marketing. You know, you think about a market with 32 restaurants, 8 bars, shops, music, etc., which is the best of Lisbon under one roof. Now we are opening 5 of them in the next 12 months in New York, in Miami, in Chicago, in Boston, and in Montreal. And we have a pipeline for other places around the world. Clearly, that's cost a lot of money to put together, but that is bringing the Time Out brand under the brand Time Out Market to a lot of other people, the existing people who like Time Out, but also new people who don't know what Time Out is and in places that maybe we are not as famous as others. That type of revenue obviously is going to change a lot how the company will look like in the next 3 to 5 years. Imagine one of these babies could do between 20 to 30 million of revenue, pounds a year. Not net revenue for us, but overall what is called TTV, total transaction value. So imagine that, how it looks against our revenue today. Then you also see how we have been growing our digital advertising and our e-commerce, you know, allowing people to buy the things that they read about as well. And that shows how that is changing the shape of the company. Although, you know, still advertising is one of the important things that we do, and sponsoring advertising and programmatic advertising, that's, you know, quite new. Although it feels old now, it's like 3 years, but it's still quite new. And that means that when you look, even today, you mentioned that print is no longer the number one revenue. And clearly, if it were, it would be a problem today, right? Because you know what is happening in the world normally with print. But we believe print, as I said before, as part of who we are, a part of this platform agnostic way of looking at the company.
Tony, do you think that if we look at the next generation of budding journalists or editors, is there room for the purist? Or does every good future editor need to be part publisher, part businessman? Do you think that we've gone beyond the days where I just have a passion about editing copy and putting story lists together? Do you need to have those hats that you can switch between on?
Well, I think what I'd loosely call the administrative side, i.e. editing and copy editing things, yes, there's obviously a degree of flexibility. And there's some examples, aren't there, of people who've caused lots of problems where, you know, some digital guy ends up all being the editor of a national newspaper, etc. But below that, in the terms of creating content, I think there will always be room for experts. While we still have discernible genres of culture, you know, from music, theatre, art, there will always be people who love those areas. And it's always something I've noticed over the 50 years, the number of young people who suddenly kind of you meet and they're absolutely passionate about film and music, and many go on to write about it. And so hopefully, you know, there will always be a demand for that kind of mosaic of information from lots of experts, you know.
Now, it would be remiss, and even when you say 50 years, I still can't quite believe it, Tony. I don't know how you get your mind around these things, but it would be remiss not to talk about some highlights, lowlights, humorous asides, if you will. And I've been sort of thinking back to some stories, and I don't wonder whether they're all true or some apocryphal tales. Back to the early 80s and Hunter S. Thompson. Is this true, Tony? And if it is, or in fact, even if it isn't, can you refresh our memories?
You're asking me about? I mean,
well, this is when around the time of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the sort of stage version, Hunter S. Thompson was commissioned, I guess.
I think as far as I remember, and there was a sort of internal connection that one of the editors at the time, I think, actually had met him at some stage or whatever. I think we must have paid for him to come to London and put him up in a hotel, and I'm not sure which. I would like to say it was the Ritz, but it probably wasn't as sort of classy as that. And it is probably true that, yes, he ran up tons of expenses and et cetera. And he was supposed to write, you know. And then the deadline loomed. And I think in the end, Ralph Steadman actually stepped in and did the copy. And Ralph did a really good cover. It was a good thing. It was one of those things that I think it was really good we tried doing it, but it wasn't as surprising that it was a bit of a difficulty managing it. You
know? that's the understanding.
He did come in the office a couple of times. He's a nice guy.
And I guess in a way, if you don't get that kind of mayhem, then he's not really fulfilled the commission strange.
But Ralph Steber was a very sort of grounded guy who kept the ship going.
Yin and yang, right? That's what they offered one another. Would you get away with that kind of thing these days, Julia, do you think? I mean, sadly, it feels like some of the, not the excesses of the industry, but some of that looser, you know, it's like, well, it's an optimistic punt, let's see what happens. Is it a shame that those days are gone? I guess with your sort of ones and zeros hat on, you're saying, no, those days are gone.
To be honest, I always have nostalgia for something that I haven't lived, right? Because when I read about things, you know, George Michael suing us, I mean, personal hero of mine, and knowing that, or Robert De Niro insulting us. And I said, oh, please, I could be insulted by Robert De Niro every day, please. So I miss something that I haven't lived. And that's when you think, oh, my God, are we too corporate? Mm-hmm. I think that it was another era as well in this country, the 70s, the 80s. Come on. I mean, the 90s I was here, and it was already very different, London, from the 70s and 80s. I wish we could have some of those crazy anecdotes. And probably the anecdotes we have now are much more like, you know, they are not X-rated, so anymore.
So easier to talk about on a broadcast.
Well, younger
maybe
people
not are better
behaved now, aren't they, than we were.
Yeah, probably we were behaving more now than when you were, Tony. Yeah.
Is that true? And I wonder, you know, it's a bit like, again, we were talking about, you know, the death of print. You know, it's constantly pronounced upon and has been since the invention of the wireless and then television and all the rest of it. Is there a risk that, especially if you've worked in the business for 50 years or 20 years or however long, that you allow nostalgia to somehow cloud your judgment? Or do you think that it's good to be nostalgic? Yeah, well, and then balancing up how you appraise the future and where you need to get better, or things that maybe you need to leave alone, or areas you need to go into. Is there a worry that we're too wistful and we lose our sort of...
No, I mean, I'm not answering your question directly, but I mean, I think the whole mission of Time Out from day one was to do information that was, in a sense, comprehensive. I mean, it's as comprehensive as you can, and also provide what I relentlessly call the information about the information, the real annotation and things like that. So I don't think there's anything I feel nostalgic about looking back. Yeah, I mean, I'm very aware, for example, that we used to have like 18 pages of music listings, and therefore, physically, when you pick the magazine up, you couldn't miss the impact that this thing told you, everything that was happening in music in that city. With online now, the depth of the information potentially can look a bit hidden, and therefore the user has to kind of go and search for it a bit and things like that. But it is there, you know. and then has the virtue that we can have even more online than we do in print. You know.
And maybe just finally, Julie, if we look, we sort of started by talking about the past and looking to the future. What are you most excited about? I mean, you've already described some very exciting shifts in the business model, expansion of markets, and what that might mean for the broader brand. What keeps you limbo? I can imagine you leaping out of bed in the morning, ready for the day's business. What's the thing you just can't wait to get stuck into?
Well, the number one thing that is in my mind is getting this company to full profitability, because 50 years, okay, happy birthday, now I need another 500 years, right? And in the world of media, that's quite tough, as you know yourself, right? So that's what keeps me up at night. But what makes me then get up and go and meet the team is, I like to say that we're in the happiness business, right? Because what we talk about is things that you do with your friends, with your family, with your loved ones, to go out in the city and enjoy it. When you forget about work, when you forget about all your worries, you just want to see a play or go to a movie. And that's happiness. And that's very important, I think, in today's world with so many things not going very well, that we have that kind of time to be happy. And I think time out, the association of time out and happiness, I think is very strong. And I like that. And that's why it keeps motivating me every day.
Well, what possibly way could you wrap things up better than that? Talk about happiness. And it is a happy birthday. It's a time out. Tony, amazing. 50 odd years. Where does the time go, right?
Yeah, 50 more to go.
He doesn't look it. He doesn't look 50, does he?
I didn't reckon when he came to the office, I was like, what have they done with Tony? This can't be him.
Yeah.
Youthful. Wonderful stuff, guys. Thanks so much for coming to see us. And here's to many more.
And finally on the show, it's time to head to Ecuador to talk about Yan, a travel magazine exploring the country. The bilingual print title will publish its 32nd edition this month, a special on the Galapagos Islands. I caught up with the editor-in-chief of Yan, Dominic Hamilton.
Yan started 5 years ago now. We're on to issue 27, and we have a philosophy of, we kind of wanted to scratch the surface, is what we kind of called it as our slogan, kind of our inner philosophy, maybe you would call it. So we only focus on this wonderful country called Ecuador, where I live and work, and we set out to find the ways of talking about the whole country. So we try and focus on just one route on one region or one theme at a time. So we have Nyan's dedicated to just one part of the Amazon. We have a couple of issues on the Galapagos. We might do one city. And also, we try and do themes that could be historical. But we also have a whole issue just about soups, which is a bit crazy. But you can do it in Ecuador, where we have lots of soups. And we made a whole issue just about soups and where they come from and where you eat them and how you eat them and all the produce. And the word Nyan comes from the Quichua. So it means road or way. So the famous Inca trail is called the Capac Nyan. So we thought that was an apt title for a magazine that talks about all these roads and ways that you can find across the country.
It is a beautiful title. I mean, it does look nice. It looks like some, you know, there's some National Geographic here. It's very beautiful. And it comes with a map as well. I love that.
Yeah, we tried to do it from the start. We felt it was important for us. The sign of success is for Nyan to come, not to be on someone's shelf, but to come back, you know, dog-eared or half-eaten by the dog in the car or the kids, and for the maps to come, you know, back damp and folded and scratched and ripped. And that's what we want people to do with the magazine, is to go out and explore. So it was a very key. There aren't particularly good maps of Ecuador. I suppose the digital age is changing that. But we were very keen right from the start that that you should be inspired by the magazine, this beautiful big format. You should be informed by the information that we've gone. We go to all these places, we find interesting, what we think is interesting things about there, and then say, okay, here you go. And with the numbers on the maps as well, with the page references, we wanted it to be practical as well. And they've turned into, some of them are kind of art objects, I suppose, as well. We commission illustrators, we commission artists to be part of the production of the maps as well.
How is it to publish a magazine in Ecuador? To be honest, I don't know much about the publishing scene in the country. You know, it's issue 27, so clearly there is a market there. Tell us, how's it been, your experience?
Well, I think it's a challenge. It's not a very literary nation. The people, you know, they're not picking up books at the end of the day. There is obviously a literary cultural scene, but the printed you know, matter isn't you know, the same as it could be in other countries. But we found we have different target audiences, which is quite hard for a magazine. You should be able to say, hey, my target audience is a world traveller and, you know, in his 50s and whatever. And in case of Nyan, we have Ecuadorians who are interested about their country. They want to learn more and they want to travel. We have foreign visitors who will find it in hotels, in restaurants, in cafes all around the country. But also a big segment are expats like me, who are living in the country maybe for a few years, maybe longer, and have a curiosity also about this adopted country, the country they're living in, they want to travel. So we have a very mixed audience. So that's, I think, enabled us to survive and thrive as a magazine. But a bit like Monocle as well, we also have a creative agency, a communications agency that helps us get on by as a magazine as well.
And in terms of the business model, do you have, for example, subscription based service as well, besides, you know, buying the newsstand or in a hotel or something?
Yeah, more and more, increasingly, we're getting better, I think, at getting our subscribers. I think once people become subscribers, then they renew, which is fantastic, and they become real fans and advocates of Nyan. And we are getting better at talking to maybe some of the foreign schools or the universities or through the embassies and people, particularly in Quito, but also in Guayaquil, who appreciate what we're putting out. And then we have advertisers. We do events as well on our own or with partners as well that are part of kind of the mix of publishing the magazine.
Issue 27 is in front of me. Can you just... The main stories, it seems to me there's a man in, like, doing some sort of water sports. I mean, can you tell us a bit more about
it? Yeah, it was very hard to find a cover image because it's the second issue we've done about adventure in Ecuador. And we've done, you know, we could do a third one, we could do a fourth one because there are so many opportunities. So it's very hard to find one image that encapsulated all these different types of adventures. But it's an issue that focuses on adventure opportunities. So this is actually, these are women, a group of women who kayak on the Amazon, one of the Amazon tributaries. And so that ended up being the image. We thought it was a strong image to go and hopefully more women will take to kayaking. But we also talk about a lot of adventure races, you know, when people go off for 3 days and they're orienteering and quite extreme races that you can do mainly in the Andes that are very popular, more and more popular. But we also touch on surfing down on the Pacific coast, paragliding in the Andes, all sorts of, and also people that are becoming famous as competitors in the various sports in Ecuador. And of course, always trying to encourage people to get out and do it themselves and experience these things for themselves.
Don, quick question. If you are an Ecuadorian news agent, besides Yan, do you have any other favorite title from the country? Or a newspaper as well?
Me personally? Or
from, yeah, you personally.
Well, we share our offices with a great title called Terra Incognita, who are been going a lot longer than we have, and all credit to them. And they touch on maybe more cultural, environmental stories. It's a smaller format magazine. And people can find it in newsagents and bookshops as well. And we actually, funnily enough, share coffee and feeding the dog and the cat as well in the office. So I'd recommend anybody to read them as well.
That was Dominic Hamilton from Nyan Magazine. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough, of course. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to me at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And meanwhile, you can always listen to it again at monocle.com or on iTunes. But to end the show, we hear a song. It's not exactly 50, but it's called 55. And it's by Brazilian duo Tecini. Hope you enjoy.
Hey, valeu. Esse é meu nome, é o meu disco. Foi feito pra aquele carinha, pra aquele pai de família. Porque uma vez a gente se encontrou no ponto de ônibus e foi legal, foi amor à primeira vista. Eu vou narrar pra você, diz aí, Brasil.